Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Tom Siegel, author of the new novel, The Astronaut's Son. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden. And we welcome two new young representatives of Israel, our Shinshinyot, Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, and Moadim LeSimcha. Very happy holidays. We have completed the High Holy Days, and so naturally the Jewish calendar launches us immediately into another major holiday, this one, Sukkot. This is a time of great joy for Jews, traditionally. We are celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, which is actually my favorite Jewish festival, in part because it's not Yom Kippur. No, in fact, I love Sukkot because of the outdoor qualities of it, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and on its central theme of gratitude, which underlies so much of all that's good about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Allow me to elaborate. Sukkot is the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that's one of the truly ancient ones on our complicated Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, also called Sukkot by many Orthodox Jews, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot is the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, little huts or booths outside the house we decorate with fruits and vegetables, in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday. It's called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, and it's filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. Sukkot's the Jewish Thanksgiving. In fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritan fathers on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles or booths established in the Torah. It was particularly an important one for our ancestors, whose whole lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter, and it was something for which to truly be grateful. The reason Sukkot was the most observed of all ancient Jewish festivals was likely because it came at the right time of year. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites were to travel to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges for farmers who wanted to walk to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these holidays. Springtime, when Passover occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that eventually results in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop, which can be harvested, of course, but there's many other crops still growing that must be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of ancient Israel. But Sukkot comes in the fall. All the crop yields are complete. The harvest is in. It's a time of plenty and an easier time to take the time, like a week, to travel to the capital and celebrate. Sukkot must have been when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem then, bringing agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, enjoying feasts every night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts used when they stayed in the fields near the crops while they were harvesting. This was a time of joy, celebration, of food and drink and great conviviality. And you know what? It still is. Sukkot's the time of year when you are commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of a sukkah, open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, the four species with which we celebrate this festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, symbolizing the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of Hachnasat Orchim, welcoming guests. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about the sukkah, one of my favorites, called a sukkala, by the oddly named Suki and Ding.
A sukkala, a kleine, vom Breitalach gemeine, hab ich mir a sukkala gemacht, badektem da. Mit a bissel schaar sitz ich mir in sickele bana badektem da mit a bissel schaar sitz ich mir in sickele bana. Wind a kalten, lust doch die Spalten, in die lächterlich sei löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch, in die lächterlich sei brennen ganz still. Es ist mir für dich, wie ich mach mir kiddisch, in die Lächterle sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, in hab nicht soll dir die Sicke nicht sein Bang. Es ist schon gut, bald 2000 Jahre, in die Sicke sie steigt noch ganz lang. Es ist schon gut,
the pretty song Asukala for the holiday of booths all this week. By the way, in Europe, there were homes that were built with a room that had a retractable roof so that it could literally be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs must have made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside. But it speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday, and to being Jewishly observant, that entire homes were designed with the sukkah used just 8 days a year in mind. It's also true that some of us only use our formal dining rooms or living rooms about that often, when we have guests over, of course. Speaking of guests, on Sukkot, we Jews symbolically welcome our ancestors to join us in our sukkah as well, our homemade tabernacle. These guests are called ushpizin, exalted guests, and they include the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, as well as Moses, Aaron, and King David. It's a nice group. More egalitarian streams of Judaism also welcome our matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and biblical figures like Miriam and Deborah as well. The phrasing is quite nice. I invite to my meal the exalted guests, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and David. May it please you, Abraham, my exalted guest tonight, that all the other exalted guests dwell with me and with you. On each day, a different one of these famous seven is singled out in order. So, invite guests, real and historically imaginary, for this great holiday of Sukkot to share in the season of joy and gratitude. Our guest this morning, Tom Siegel, was chief of the Justice Department's Brooklyn Organized Crime Strike Force. Quite a job, prosecuting members and associates of La Cosa Nostra, the Mafia. After 20 years as a litigator, he moved on to become an author, and his new book, his debut novel, is called The Astronaut's Son. He'll explain just how some very unsavory characters in history helped us reach the moon, and why he based his very entertaining and very Jewish novel on that story. Meet Tom Siegel when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Tom Siegel has a new book out. It's called The Astronaut's Son, but that's not his whole story. he is a recovering attorney who served as deputy chief and chief of the Justice Department's Organized Crime Strike Force, prosecuting mobsters in New York and elsewhere. Then he decided to become what he had probably always meant to be, a novelist. His first novel is a wonderful, interesting, and charming, if that's a good word to use, story about the guy going to the moon. Good morning, and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so tell us about your career change.
Well, it was something that I think was a few years in the making, and it was a few stages, much like a rocket to the moon comes in stages. I was, as I think you may have mentioned, a prosecutor in Brooklyn, New York, doing organized crime. And because of a career change of my wife, actually, we moved to Connecticut in 2007. And I left the government at that time and went into private practice for a while, which is a hard thing to do. It's sort of like leaving the Marines. You never really completely leave them. And so I practiced in a couple of firms for a few years, and I had started writing even before that, on and off when I had time between my work and my family. And I got to my mid-40s, and I decided that if I was going to really make a serious effort for this, I needed to do it now. And that's when I signed up for an MFA program.
Graduated, and this is sort of the first fruit of your labors, or at least the first complete fruit of your labors. It's kind of a Jewish book.
It is, and that was not the original intent, but it's taken many twists and turns, as I'm sure many writers have told you on previous occasions. Where you start is not exactly where you plan to finish. And I started with the idea of returning to the moon because, as someone of my age, I don't really remember any of the Apollo program. I was too young. And while I'm not given to believe conspiracy theories, I'm no believer in the Loch Ness Monster, and I think Bigfoot is only a monster truck that you can see on the weekends. I was captivated by the idea that we went to the moon so long ago, at least it seems so long ago for me, and it really started with that. And the Jewish element came when I learned more about NASA's history, as I read about that and learned about all of the former Nazi scientists and engineers who were brought over to work in the early days of NASA.
Including, of course, Wernher von Braun. And
probably the most famous.
Right.
And when I heard about that and learned more about that, as a writer, I thought, well, how interesting. What if I put an Israeli astronaut in the middle of those guys while they're still there? And that was when it really took off for me.
It's a very entertaining book, and we will explore The Astronaut's Son much more with Tom Siegel when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website. Top 10 in North America as podcasts, according to Moment Magazine, and you can get the download of those podcasts on iTunes. we welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Chag Sukkot Sameach.
Sukkot is my favorite holiday, by the way. Wow. A lot of people think it's my favorite holiday because it's not Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's much easier on the clergy.
Got it.
But Sukkot's a favorite holiday in Israel.
It is. We had our, you know, special tradition. So, as you know, growing up, obviously, here in the United States, it seems like when you build a sukkah, you build your own sukkah. It's like a private house and a sukkah. Neighborhood, especially in Be'er Sheva, you know, a lot of them were buildings and apartments. So having a sukkah of your own would be a challenge. So what we did was we built together.
I have seen sukkot on mirpesets on the balcony, just kind of not much of a sukkah,
right,
to be honest, but a little
true
bit of palm over something.
That's true. So what we did was, growing up, you know, a couple of fathers and a couple of children who were older will help out and go and bring whatever you need to do to bring in order to build the sukkah. We'll build the sukkah. We will be one huge sukkah for the neighborhood. We'll have shifts of dinners, you know, coming in and out, but the special magic was that the children would sleep at the sukkah.
Yeah.
So, you know, to show you how safe our world was, you know. So, no adults. The adults would be sleeping at home, and just the children will hang out. And we had, obviously, you know, break from school, and we'll spend the nights there.
Now, Sukkot is a vacation week, usually.
Correct.
In Israeli schools, just like Pesach's a vacation week in the spring.
Right. So other days, they, you know, in our days, what they do is they go abroad for vacations.
Right. So what I was telling
they
you
fly,
earlier, you know, when I lived in Israel, I went scuba diving in the Sinai.
Wow.
After the first day of Sukkot, we'd go scuba diving for a few days and come back.
Yeah.
It's common to go to Eilat or go up to the Galil or somewhere.
Right.
It's a beautiful time of year in Israel.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
And a great time to spend outdoors. You know, Israel, we think about it as with this great agricultural history of the yeshuv and the rebuilding of the agriculture in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of Israelis that work in agriculture has plummeted.
Correct, because everyone wants to be his own boss, you know. That's true. Everyone goes to high tech, you know.
Everybody's in high tech. Whatever they do, it's high tech.
That's true.
But still, I think there's a closer connection to the land than we
no,
tend
no, of
to
course.
Have.
And we still have kibbutzim, and we still have moshavim.
Right?
You know, so the kibbutzim and moshavim, obviously, you know, many of them work the land, but it is a tradition to visit places, you know, in Sukkot, and to go and to explore and to get to know, and to share what you know about the country, you know, with the little ones, so they'll know, and then generation to generation.
It's nice. It's a beautiful way to do it. Listen, this is Zman Simchatenu, a season of joy. May it be a great season for you and for your family.
Same to you.
We will talk next week.
Thanks.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about, in recent weeks, is kind of a long exploration of ghettoization and self-ghettoization. We've been talking about what I would term Klal Yisrael, sort of the notion of the community of Israel in America, the idea of Jews working, as we might put it, borrowing a Christian term, ecumenically across Jewish lines, being comfortable with that, respecting that they were different, but not seeing it as some barrier, really, to interaction. That world has gone away, almost.
Yeah, sadly, I think that spirit of Klal Yisrael and doing things together as a whole Jewish community is very much on the decline. And instead, we've seen over the last few decades a rise of, I don't know, tribalism or rival factions that really don't treat each other very kindly or very respectfully, let alone engage in joint actions. And part of this has to do with the relationship between Israel and the diaspora and the evolution of the so-called Jewish state, the State of Israel, which is historically still a very new phenomenon.
71 years.
Israel is increasingly driven by something that its founders would not have imagined, which is an extreme religious right, conservative with a small c. And there are many Israelis who feel that that element of Israeli society has way too much power. And there are certainly people in the diaspora who feel that way. But there are also people in the diaspora who feel that it is in the interest of American Jews to support whatever government is most right wing, whether in Washington or in Jerusalem.
Well, there's been a political element that's infused, and it is pretty much along movement lines, to be perfectly frank, which you didn't see. You know, most Jews came from the same part of the world, and in fact, you can see a kind of reversal. You were likely to see Reform Jews be Republicans in the early days because they were German Jews who were...
They were more assimilated.
Yeah, they were more assimilated, and now it's quite the opposite. You're much more likely to see Reform Jews be liberal Democrats and Orthodox Jews be conservative Republicans.
Right. Well, you know how I feel about American meddling in Israeli politics. I feel like if you want to make a comment, go there, become a citizen, fight in the army, pay your taxes, and vote. Otherwise, keep your mouth shut. But... that being said, within North America, I think it's very dangerous and regrettable and lamentable that there's such a distance between and among the various elements of the Jewish community, to the point that, you know, I have very close friends who are Orthodox Jews living in Seattle, and their kids all went to the Northwest Yeshiva High School. And one day, the youngest of those children came home from school and said, you know what we learned in school today? The rabbi told us that the Reform and the conservative Jews are worse enemies than Amalek and his descendants. And I looked appalled, and this kid's father said, you can't take everything my son says literally. It's not necessarily exactly what the rabbi said. He may be dramatizing. But even if that's just what he came away with, and it's not what the rabbi said, that is a regrettable state of affairs.
Yeah, I hope in this new year we can do something about rebuilding some of those important bridges and connections in Klal Yisrael. Thanks,
and
Tom.
Good luck to you and to all of us.
No kidding. We'll talk next week.
Okay.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. So a guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York City. His non-Jewish landlord is so irate, he sues him and asks the judge to force the tenant to remove the illegal structure. In court, the judge agrees with the landlord. I understand, sir, you have no permit for this unauthorized structure. That's true, Your Honor, says the Jewish guy, but it's a religious requirement. Well, that may very well be true, but this tabernacle structure has to go, declares Judge Feldman. I order you to remove it within 10 days. Next case. You see, by 10 days, Sukkot's over, you have to take it down anyway. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. The Boy Scouts of America have gone through many changes over the last 5 years, and you may not know about them. The Boy Scouts now include boys who are members of the LGBT community and leaders from the LGBT community. Just last year, a pilot program for boys 5 years old and in kindergarten was added, and a family program for girls 5 through 9 years old who can now join Cub Scouts. A key Boy Scout law says a scout is reverent, and duty to God is now a component for scout rank. Interfaith prayer is used whenever members of multiple faiths are present. In the early 70s, some Jewish organizations dropped sponsorship of scouting because of the lack of inclusion, but it's time for the Jewish community to return to its support for this great organization. Judaism shares principles that are represented and taught by the Boy Scouts of America. Scouting's a great place to inculcate good values and a shared philosophy, develop better adjusted and contributing young people who will become future leaders. Scouting is more than camping. It's a variety of activities promoting physical and mental health and emotional growth. Scouting schedules activities so as not to interfere with religious and other family activities and to include other members of the nuclear family. Scouting's an enhancement of religious, communal, and familial life. And that's true from the youngest level of scouting. Currently, only one unit chartered by a Jewish organization, PAC 613 in Tucson, exists in the state of Arizona. If you are in the Tucson area, contact Herb at Shofarman, S-H-O-F-A-R-M-A-N, at AOL.com, or call the Catalina Council at 520-750-0385. That's 750-0385. New members are very welcome in the scouting family. Scouting's there for all members, in good times and bad, helping in every way. Contact the Scouting Council in your area. Go to www.beascout.org or www.my.scouting.org. Ask your local council if they have a Jewish committee on scouting who can come to your synagogue or organization and see if scouting is just the thing to further your mission to the community. You can also contact the National Jewish Committee on Scouting, www.jewishscouting.org. Scouting is great for you and your family. We welcome our Shin Shin Yoda representatives, our young representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center, Ron Benakot and Rotem Rappaport. It's Sukkot coming really soon. Chag Sameach, Moadim LeSimcha.
Chag Sameach.
So, my favorite holiday, as I've said many times, how about you guys?
Well, it's my favorite holiday too. Such a great holiday.
And why?
First, it's my birthday. I was born right before Sukkot.
Yom Huledet Sameach.
Happy
birthday to you.
Thank you. And I always get to celebrate my birthday on the Sukkah, which is fine with all my family.
And it's always a nice time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And the weather is nice and just all of the tradition and this holiday, I love it.
Rotem, how about you? What does Sukkot mean to you? How did you experience it in Israel?
I really love this holiday. We celebrate it because it's a long holiday with 7 days in the Sukkah.
And no school, I might add, in Israel.
No school. You can celebrate it with your family and you can celebrate with your friends. You have a lot of time to meet all of the people you love and celebrate with them this holiday. And that's why I love it.
So I have to confess that I was in Israel over Sukkot only once because, you know, it's not like rabbis get a lot of time off during the holidays. And when I was a student there, and I decided to go scuba diving in Sinai after the first day of Sukkot.
Oh, that's cool.
That was not a bad way to spend it and then come back. But I will tell you, one of the interesting things you see is you see all of these huts, and they're not Jewish huts, right? They're just the Bedouin huts. They look just like Sukkot.
Exactly.
So I think everybody in Israel automatically should know how to build a Sukkah. It's been in that part of the world a really long time.
Yes, it is. But just the Sukkah itself, we all really get together to build it, and it's really fun thing you can do with your family because everyone can chip in. I mean, the kids make the decorations and the older one just build it. It's really fun.
And what do you use for schach? Do you use palm fronds on top of your Sukkot?
Because
as we do here
trees.
In the desert. I know back east sometimes people use pine, they use different kinds of leaves. When I lived in South Carolina, it was whatever, there was tons of trees, none
really?
Of them were palms. But so it doesn't really matter, but sitting outside and having that experience, it's a time of gratitude. Even though Israelis are not so involved with agriculture anymore, there's still that feeling about the land, isn't there?
Yes, definitely. And especially where we live, I think, because we live in a moshav, and it's really...
And a moshav is kind of a collective farm, but not exactly, not like a kibbutz.
Yeah, but our school is in a kibbutz.
Uh-huh.
So we're very connected to nature and to the land and trees and fruits and stuff like that. I really love it.
So there's lots of agriculture where you guys actually live.
Yeah, there's a lot of nature. There's a lot of agriculture. There's a lot of farmers. And you'll see it like from... You see it around you. You see hay and you see trees. So it's really like connected to your... childhood memories and your, you know, background.
Right, and so harvest really means something.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, listen, Chag Sameach, a wonderful holiday Sukkot.
Thank you, Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, is easy to overlook in the context of the fast flow of fall festivals. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are followed just 4 days later, as you know by now, by the harvest holiday, whose principal observances seem based in an earlier age, the agricultural celebration of bringing in the fruits, vegetables, and grains that'll carry us through a barren winter. In today's world, where food comes from around the globe and virtually any kind of produce is available year-round, a particular week to celebrate reaping the rewards of the natural world seems archaic. But the move in recent years towards locally sourced produce and grains produced using sustainable agricultural methods from native seeds and finding fruits, vegetables, and other natural products at farmers' markets and through growers' cooperatives, well, all of this testifies to an understanding that what we produce from the ground nearby with God's help is the best food to eat and serve our children. There's nothing tastier than ripe, fresh vegetables and fruits harvested recently at the proper time and season. They taste better and offer many health and environmental benefits as well for us and for the planet. Perhaps that's the way God intended us to live. For our ancestors in ancient Israel, Sukkot was considered to be the most important observance, Hechag, the holiday. Of all the festivals, this is the one most often referred to in the Bible, and it must have been the one on which the most people came to express their gratitude to God in Jerusalem. Sukkot in ancient Jerusalem must have been a remarkable scene. Sukkahs all over the city, songs and feasts for the full week. Well, our focus on Sukkot in the Torah readings is on thanksgiving to God for the bounty of the harvest. Zman Simchatenu, this time of our joy, is blessed with Torah portions that primarily focus on the rituals of this ancient festival, with a few additional mystical passages. But here, too, the Torah reminds us that we exist solely through the grace of God. We offer thanks for the food and the natural world that God has created to help provide for our needs. It's a good reminder from the Torah this week, and always. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Tom Siegel, will explain just how some very odd characters helped us reach the moon and why he based his very entertaining and very Jewish novel on that story of, well, a Jewish astronaut. Find out in a moment when we come back on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, Syria accidentally shot down a Russian military plane in a case of friendly fire, and Israel was blamed. But apparently, the brief and highly publicized crisis that event caused in Israeli-Russian relations is now over, although the incident highlights just how active the Israeli Air Force has been attacking Iranian targets in Syria during the civil war there. And with the brutal Assad regime about to finish off winning this long Syrian civil war, it also raises questions about how the Israeli military will now stop Syria from transferring high-level weapons to the Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon for future use against Israel. In the incident last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the downing of the Russian military plane by Syrian air defenses was the result of a tragic chain of circumstances. This is an apparent effort to calm tensions after his country's own defense ministry accused Israel of hostile actions. The downing of the jet highlighted the dangers posed by the conflicting interests of a variety of powers in the crowded skies over war-torn Syria, and it threatened to damage relations between Russia and Israel. It was also the worst case of friendly fire between Russia and Syria since Moscow's military intervention in the country in support of President Bashar al-Assad's forces began in earnest back in September 2015. The Russian military said the electronic intelligence plane was hit by Syrian anti-aircraft fire 35 kilometers off of Syria's Mediterranean coast as it returned to its home base. All 15 Russian crew members were killed. Russian defense officials described maneuvers by Israeli fighter jets during the incident as hostile and initially said Russia had a right to retaliate. The Israeli pilots were using the Russian aircraft as a shield and pushed it into the line of fire of the Syrian defense. Igor Konashenkov, Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson, told the Russian state media. A warning from Israel was received less than a minute before the strike, which left no chance for taking the Russian plane to safety. But Putin later struck a more conciliatory tone, telling reporters the shooting down of the plane was the result of a chain of tragic and chance circumstances. As for retaliatory measures, they will be aimed first and foremost at further ensuring the safety of our military personnel and facilities in Syria, and these will be steps everyone will notice, Putin said. It was a different situation when a Turkish jet shot down a Russian fighter jet on the Syrian border 3 years ago, according to the Russian czar, president. The Turkish fighter jet shot down our plane on purpose, Putin said. Putin's use of measured language clearly shows he does not want to escalate this situation any further. The difference in tone between the Russian Ministry of Defense and Putin suggests the Russian president is now satisfied the point has been made, and this chain of circumstances shouldn't risk a pretty good working relationship between Russia and Israel. Earlier, the Israeli military rejected claims its fighter jets had indirectly caused the incident, said it holds Syria, Iran, and Lebanon's Hezbollah responsible for it. It confirmed it targeted a Syrian military facility that was about to transfer weapons to Hezbollah on behalf of Iran, a major ally of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But it insisted the Russian plane had been felled by extensive and inaccurate Syrian anti-aircraft fire, adding anti-air batteries did not bother to ensure no Russian planes were in the air. By the time the Russian plane was hit, the Israeli jets were already out of Syria and back in their own airspace. For his part, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu quickly called Putin to express sorrow over the death of the plane's crew, blamed the plane's loss squarely on Syria, and offered to send Israel's Air Force chief to Moscow to share information about the incident. The Israeli leader said his country would keep acting against Iran in Syria. Putin told Netanyahu the Israeli raid violated Syria's sovereignty and breached the Russian-Israeli deconfliction agreement. He urged the Israeli side not to allow such situations to happen again. For several years, Israel and Russia have maintained a special hotline to prevent their air forces from clashing in the skies over Syria. Israeli military officials have previously praised its effectiveness. Since intervening in Syria's war, Russia has generally turned a blind eye to Israeli attacks inside the country. Israel has carried out about 200 air raids in the last 2 years. A dispute between Israel and Russia could restrict Israel's ability to mount air raids inside Syria. What it considers the greatest threat to its security from the Syria conflict, the buildup of Iranian forces or Iranian-backed Hezbollah fighters. Just a week ago, Israel attacked Damascus International Airport with missiles. A war monitoring group said the attack targeted an arms depot for Iranian forces, or perhaps Lebanon's Hezbollah group. Although Israel rarely acknowledges attacks inside Syria, earlier this month an Israeli military official said the IDF has struck over 200 Iranian targets in Syria over the past 18 months. U.S. and Israeli officials have said that Iran and Hezbollah should end their armed presence in Syria. Israel is alarmed by the expansion of operations by Iran and Hezbollah. When Assad finishes off the last of his Syrian opposition, it will be much more difficult for Israel to interdict those operations. And in happier news, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel won the Emmy for Best Show and a number of other Emmys as well. This magnificent, very Jewish comedy show deserves all it got. Two of its stars, of course, are past guests of Too Jewish. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Tom Siegel is the author of the debut novel, The Astronaut's Son. It's about a privately coordinated and financed trip to the moon. I don't want to give away too much, but you give that away pretty quickly. And really an extraordinary and entertaining story. Tell us, when you started to dig into the story of the, as we mentioned earlier, the German scientists who were brought over to help launch the U.S. rocket program and then really to launch NASA. Did you discover stuff you didn't expect?
I did. First, I was a little embarrassed that I didn't know more about it sooner. I think I had a vague notion that there had been some German scientists come over to work in NASA in the early days, but I think like many people, that notion was colored by some of the explanation slash press slash propaganda that they were all just nominal Nazis and forced to do the bidding of the Third Reich and happy to be liberated.
Just following orders.
Exactly. Simple scientists doing their research and happy to be liberated. And as I read more about it, it became more complicated and more interesting. Flaubert says the more you look at something, the more interesting it becomes, and I think that that's true for history, of course. And here, it was not the case that they were all nominal in any way, and there was a lot of, and this is a word that we hear a lot these days, complicity that was going on during the war with a lot of these individuals. And I think they, in an opportunistic way, were very happy to run into the arms of the U.S. soldiers who were looking for them.
Well, they were certainly happier than they would have been had they run into the Russian.
And that's exactly right. And it was a race. The Russians had a list of scientists, and so did the U.S. Military, and they were scouring the countryside as the war ended to try to find as many of the scientists as they could.
Now, Neil Armstrong plays an interesting role in this book. Can you talk about it a little bit without giving away too much?
Sure. I think he's more of a presence in the book than he actually appears as a fictional character. It is a novel, of course, drawn from a lot of real life events inspired by them. I think he's an interesting character because he's certainly the most famous astronaut in the world and one of the most famous people of all time, yet he was a very reclusive person. He wasn't a hermit. He would appear at some events, and he would sign the occasional autograph, but he really did avoid the spotlight. And I think a character like that is always interesting. When you have someone with all the fame in the world who shuns it, I think that that's a good place to work as a writer and to explore that a bit. And then that, for me, with my main character, Jonathan, whose father died at a very young age, Neil Armstrong fills a certain void in his imagination, even though they don't know each other.
His father, of course, was supposed to be, was an astronaut, and that tragedy shows up pretty early in the book. I remember a movie when I was young called Capricorn One about NASA faking a landing on the moon. And that kind of conspiracy theory plays a role here also. Can you explore that a little bit?
Absolutely. So Capricorn One, which is a movie I watched for my research, and entertaining enough, not a great flick.
Although I have to say, in that movie, the astronaut who dies earliest because of physical limitations is O.J. Simpson, which immediately raises all kinds of doubts about how practical it all was. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's right. And if I remember correctly, I think the way they dealt with it was that it was meant to be a mission to Mars that was faked.
I think you're right,
But it's the same concept of the mission. And so there are, of course, many people out there, thousands of people, who believe that the moon landings were faked. And there's a lot of literature, and there's, of course, a lot online about it. And I felt that exploring some of that, but then going in a different direction would be interesting. Because it has held the interest and imagination of so many people, I thought, as a writer, let's explore why that conspiracy theory seems to have purchase after so many years and after so much evidence that we, of course, have been to the moon. So we head down that road in the novel, but then quickly turn a different direction. I'm not giving away very much to say my main character, Jonathan, doesn't really ever believe that the moon landing was fake.
Sure. There's a lot of sort of homey quality to it, too. His relationship with his wife, who's pregnant at the start, and I don't want to give away too much, but it's a pretty interesting and Jewish part. His own medical situation, it's sort of a complicated mix from the beginning.
It is. Well, I there's a link, obviously. We're talking about generation to generation here, which is a very Jewish theme. And we have the father who died perhaps of a heart attack. We later learn perhaps not. His son has a heart condition which may or may not be serious. And so it creates a strong link with his father that he already has. He's following his father's footsteps, after all, trying to accomplish the dream his father couldn't realize. So tying those things together, creating that sense of family, that sense of history, I think adds another element to the book.
Jewish astronauts, there have been a couple. Did you get to talk to any of them in the course of this?
I didn't, but I can tell you that that was part of the inspiration for what ultimately became the final version of this novel. When I was doing my research again, We have two tragic instances, where first Judith Resnick, who was on the Challenger, the American Jewish astronaut, died, and then Ilan Ramon, the first Israeli astronaut, died tragically on the Columbia. And that was around the time of the setting of this book. That was in 2003. And so I thought about that as well, and the tragedy and the loss of that, of these people reaching for heights that they weren't able to reach. And that as well, for me, just for me, solidified the idea that I should really, there needs to be a strong Jewish element to this story about making it to the moon.
So there have been now a fair number of private companies that have launched rockets, SpaceX among them. There's a new Israeli kind of co-venture that's just been announced, came out perfectly in time for your book's release, actually, about an effort to send an unmanned craft to the moon. It's becoming exciting and dynamic again. Why is it taking so long?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And I think that there are, and I, you know, want to make sure I put in the disclaimer that I am not a historian or an expert in the space industry. I'm a humble writer. But I think that there are a lot of political issues. There are funding issues. There's the question of what are we going to get out of it. And what's actually one of the interesting things I learned from the research is we really may never have gone to the moon but for Wernher von Braun and his dream to do it and his ability, because he had a P.T. Barnum quality to him. He was quite a salesman.
He was a showman, really.
He was really able to convince the U.S. military that the Russians were on our heels to the moon and we had better get there first. And it's not clear that that was true. But he wanted it to be true because he got the funding and he got the resources to get the project done. And that is quite interesting. So why haven't we gone back? I think for a combination of financial and scientific reasons. But it looks like we're headed there now in a commercial way, which is what the book envisions.
Do you think there's a follow-up book here?
I don't know. I wouldn't rule it out. I am working on something new, but it's not a sequel. But it's possible. It's possible that the story could continue.
When, by the way, in promoting the book, you all sent out, your publicist sent out some of that freeze-dried ice cream.
Yes.
I don't really know what to say about it, except it bears the same relationship to ice cream that Tang does to orange juice.
I think that's a fair comparison. And the truth of it, of course, is that the what is famous, the freeze-dried astronaut ice cream, never went out into space. It's not practical in space. The little crumbles would float everywhere and get in the machinery and be a problem. So it's been sold a lot and it's fun, and we thought it would be fun to include with the promotional materials. But in truth, the freeze-dried ice cream has always stayed on Earth.
It has never gone into orbit. Tragic.
I know.
Would you like to go up in a spaceship sometime?
I would. But I don't know if I could handle the small quarters and the G-force. I'm not, I don't think, I have trouble enough on a commercial flight. So I think I'll probably keep both feet on the ground. But part of me would, of course, love to see what it would be like to be up in orbit or beyond.
I want to explore a little more just about, in addition to the German, well, basically the Nazi scientist aspect to the book, and frankly to the whole U.S. space program originally. You know, it is a pretty darn Jewish book. Explore that a little bit.
Well, I think there are, I hope in any good novel there are many threads that we could talk about. And in this one, while we're talking about going back to space, it's really about a father looking for a son.
A son really looking for his father.
I said it backwards. And feeling a bit lost without him, feeling as an outsider in some sense, looking for that connection that he wanted to have. He has a close relationship with his mother, which is important, but he's in a sense looking for his father. And whenever you have a novel where you're looking for an absent parent, it's not too far to say, are you looking for a closer connection with God? And I think that there's an element of that. And I think While that's never articulated in the book, I feel it, and I felt it while I was writing it. And I also think that Jonathan is very aware of his Jewishness and his Israeli background in contrast to the, let's say, extremely Gentile background of the U.S. military and NASA, and how he feels that to sort of follow his father's footsteps is to overcome the obstacles that maybe have been set in place in the past for people like Jonathan to participate in those types of institutions.
Just one more comment, which is it is sort of stunning to think that in 1969 we landed on the moon with about the same computing capacity. Well, you have more computing capacity in your iPhone. It's stunning with the level of technological development. It ought to be easy, but it probably still isn't, is it?
I think it's probably not that easy. And again, it is expensive. And whenever you deal with expense, I think that's why we're seeing the commercial ventures as the likely candidates to get back, because they don't have to deal with the politics, which can always bog down a project.
So if it's funded by someone who expects to make money out of it, it's a better setup.
I think that might be right.
I want to thank Tom Siegel for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called The Astronaut's Son, a very entertaining, very interesting novel. First novel. Where can people go to find out more about you and about the book?
Well, thanks for asking. And again, thank you for having me. They can find the book online at all the familiar purveyors of books online. It's available for, it will be available for pre-order and order. And you can go to my website, tomsiegel.com. And it's, I have an unusual spelling of Siegel. It's S-E-I-G-E-L, which is probably an Ellis Island accident.
Yeah, just like Cohan, I might add, C-O-H-O-N. So I appreciate the challenge of spelling it for everyone for the rest of your life.
Yes, I've done it many times, and my children have learned to do it many times.
That's right.
As well.
That's right. Tom, thanks so much, and best of luck, and we look forward to what comes next also.
I appreciate it very much. Thanks for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here on Too Jewish this morning with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Stephen R. Weissman, author of The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is the Hasidic Kaddish. We sang it at the end of Yom Kippur last week, but it's appropriate for every joyous festival, like, you know, Sukkot. May you have a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot, a Zman Simchatenu, a time of joy, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Iskada shemela ba, ve'ol hodi ve'lokirose, ve'yamlik malchose, ve'kayichon yomecho, ve'kayed kol beis Yisrael, ba'galon ve'zman koyli, ve'yimru, Shemed kusha,
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.